Tonight on Coast to Coast, we're going to talk about the re-enchantment, a shamanic path to a life of wonder. How many people are unhappy these days? They feel disoriented, alienated. In a moment, Hank Wesselman back on Coast to Coast. We're going to talk about, well, how to get better on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Well, he was last with me about 5 years ago, Hank Wesselman, of course. Cutting-edge scientist, walks many worlds. He served in the Peace Corps, living among the Yoruba tribe in Nigeria, where he first became interested in indigenous spiritual traditions. Now, for the past 45-plus years, Hank has been conducting research with an international group of scientists exploring the fossil beds of eastern Africa's Great Rift Valley in search of answers to the mystery of human origins again. And he is a shamanic practitioner and teacher. Welcome back to Coast, Dr. Hank Wesselman, with his new book, The Re-Enchantment, A Shamanic Path to a Life of Wonder. Hank, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Way too long. Good to have you back.
Hey, George, it's good to hear your voice. You know, somewhere but way back when, I recall that you were actually out here, were you?
Yes.
Creating a life for yourself out here. Are you still here?
Well, no. What I did is we built a studio there, but I have to have the time to get up there. Producer Tom has had me so busy on weekends traveling around the country at all my events. But we have a studio on the Big Island, Hank.
Well, that's wonderful. You know, I know exactly what you mean because, you know, in my shamanic training workshops, I take about 40 airplane flights a year, and it takes me a day to get from
it does.
The island of Hawaii to the mainland, and then it takes me a day to get anywhere else. So I understand exactly what you mean in terms of travel.
Well, but when I get up there, we'll get together, okay?
Let's do that.
All right. So what have you been doing over the past 5 years that we haven't talked?
Well, you know, over the past 5 years, I continue to do research on the fossil faunas of these paleoanthropological sites from Ethiopia, on the one hand. And on the other hand, as I've said, you know, I teach probably 20 workshops a year at places like the Esalen Institute, the Omega Institute, the Breitenbusch Conference Center in Oregon. You know, I do things for the New Thought people here on the island of Hawaii as well. And, you know, what I do is I try to bring people into the mystic experience. You know, this is something we've talked about before. I try to give people a connection with these inner worlds. You know, the indigenous people of the world understand that reality presents itself to us in two halves. There's the world of things which is seen, which we're so familiar with, and the world of things which is hidden. And the shaman's path is about investigating and penetrating and going into these worlds of things hidden. And the interesting thing about shamans is, you know, what I discovered when I stepped onto this path myself is that these inner worlds are inhabited. They're inhabited by transpersonal forces that traditional people call spirits. And, you know, just frankly, because I know you're interested in the whole alien phenomenon, mm-hmm. the alien abduction phenomenon, you know, I've often wondered if the aliens are actually spirits. I haven't had a lot of direct experience with them myself, but I know that many people have. And years and years ago, I had an EEG, EKG done on my EEG, I think, on my brain waves. By a psychologist from the University of Illinois at Chicago, and he discovered that I can voluntarily achieve these very, very deep brainwave states, which are called the gamma rhythm. And there are not that many people who can do that, but he had been studying in Brazil for about a decade, I think, on an NIH grant, and he discovered about 14 or 15 other people who could do this. And he discovered that all of them had had the alien abduction experience.
Hmm.
And so he asked me straight out if I'd ever had the alien abduction experience. And I had to tell him, well, I don't think so. But, you know, and this was this was something a lot of my readership found fascinating. He had a colleague from Brazil who called me the next day. He called her and then she called me on her nickel, all the way from Brazil to Sacramento, California, where I was living at that time. And with her permission, she put me into a deep state of hypnosis. I was lying on the bed with a phone tucked into my ear. And she regressed me back to the time I was about 3 or 4 months old, lying in my crib, when I had a very strange experience. You know, I'd been put into my crib for a nap, and being a boy, I wasn't the least bit interested in napping. I was interested in bugging. I was
even at that age, right?
Yeah. And what happened was there was this sound, and this sound rose in frequency. It became higher and higher and higher, and then suddenly it just went beyond my capacity to hear it, and I couldn't remember anything that happened after that. Now, whether or not this classifies as an alien experience, I don't know. It could be a spiritual experience. But, you know, I can do some very interesting things with my brain waves. And this was very reassuring to me to learn that science could actually verify and validate what it is that I've written about in my unusual books.
Tell us a little bit, before we get into your work here, the latest one, about some of your anthropology work that you've done.
Well, you know, as many of your listeners know, I've been involved in working with several research expeditions, primarily in Ethiopia and Kenya, for the last 45 years or so, since 1971, when I was a grad student at Berkeley. And what I do is I go to sites where important discoveries are made, and I pass the sediments, the back dirt, so to speak, from excavations through very fine screens, and I extract the bones of very small mammals, like mice and rats and bats and shrews and hedgehogs and galagos and stuff like that. And these are creatures that live very short lives in very small home ranges, so they tend to be very habitat-specific. So if I can find them, and I've been very good at doing that, you know, I can tell a great deal about the environment of the site at the time it was laid down. So most recently, I've been involved in a research expedition in northeastern Ethiopia along the Awash River, where we've been recovering the fossilized remains of an early kind of human, or maybe proto-human, which has been called by science Ardipithecus ramidus. And this is between 4 and 5 million years old.
Wow.
About 4.5, to be precise. And in 1994, 95, 96, I was actually part of an excavation crew where we discovered half of a skeleton of this creature. And this thing is so primitive, it literally may be the missing link that Charlie Darwin predicted that we would eventually find in Africa. It's literally half ape, half human. And it actually made the cover of National Geographic magazine. I think in July 2010, there was a picture of the skull on the cover, the skull of the 4-million-year-old woman. And I was one of the excavators on that site.
Was that Lucy?
So, you know, this is just fascinating stuff for me.
Was that the one they called Lucy?
No, Lucy is actually a million years younger. Lucy is about 3.1, 3.2 million years. And, of course, she's very famous because Don Johansson, the guy who found her, is very good at promoting promoting the work that he's done. But she's also a very fascinating creature and may, in fact, be in the direct ancestral lineage of humans. But she's more human than this Ardipithecus creature from a million and a half years earlier.
Is the other one a little more ape-like, you think?
Well, the creature around 4.5 called Ardipithecus, I mean, this guy could abduct his big toe. You know, this guy could climb trees with ease.
Mm-hmm.
He was also adapted to walking upright on the earth, on the ground. In other words, he was bipedal. And that seems to be the first stage that humans moved into in their evolutionary process across time. The expansion of the brain came later with the genus Homo, when we started to scavenge big game kills on the plains of East Africa. And what's really interesting is, you know, we can see a lot of evidence for this in the fractured bones from carnivore kills with cut marks on them made by stone tools. And the minute these early kinds of humans began to eat meat, the brain begins to expand. And in fact, within the next million years, the brain literally tripled its size in response to a carnivorous diet. And we can see the stone tool technology and the archaeology becomes more sophisticated with pre-planned designs as well. And so, you know, our whole human adventure, you know, is revealed in that period of time between literally about 4.5 million years ago and about 1 million years ago. And we have these extraordinary sequences of sediments, sedimentary deposits with fossils in them, in the along the Awash River in northeastern Ethiopia. And this is the group I've been working with for about 20 years now.
How tall would this creature have been, Hank?
Well, you know, the females were considerably smaller than the males, and this is in alignment with what we know about other primates as well. You know, the males might have been 4.5 to 5 feet tall, and the females were more like 3.5 to 4 feet tall.
Wow.
In other words, this is called sexual dimorphism, in which, you know, there's a difference in size between the males and the females. They had very small thumbs, by the way, until we start to make stone tools. And then the thumb suddenly gets rather large, so we have that power grip with which we can hold pieces of stone and pieces of bone and antler and so forth and so on. It's, you know, it's a fascinating field to be involved in. You know, I've been doing it for the best part of my life.
It's incredible.
It continues to be an area of great interest to me. In addition, of course, to the spiritual work that I do with all this shamanism stuff. And, you know, that's what the reenchantment is really about. I hope you enjoyed that book. It's a quick read.
I did. It came in yesterday. And it's very well done. And it, as a matter of fact, it shows to me the two different lives you lead, one being the real pure scientist and the other being very shaman-like.
You know, this, you know, requires a lot from me as well. I'm pretty good at keeping the two separate. I mean, when I'm doing science, I'm in my mental mode. But when I'm, you know, involved in visionary work, I'm actually working through my, what the Jungians would call my subconscious mind. There seems to be a doorway, a kind of doorway that we can learn how to open with training and with intention, which allows us to project part of our conscious awareness into these inner worlds where we discover these transpersonal forces, some of whom are inclined to come into relationship with us. And that's part of what this, the reenchantment is all about. But, you know, as I said in the beginning of that book, it all began for me when I was a little boy living in New York, through my connection with nature, which for me was Central Park.
You could go there in those days, right?
And I touch base with all my trees that I used to, you know, play with when I was a little boy. You know, now I'm 75 years old, so they're considerably larger. And, of course, I'm considerably older. But, you know, this is where the enchantment really began. You know, I remember, you know, having these insights when I was about 3 or 4 years old, when I would see these squirrels and pigeons and trees, and I realized that they were living beings but like myself, but they were different. They were different, and I was aware of that. And then, of course, there was the Central Park Zoo, and I've written about this in the beginning of the reenchantment, where my au pair, my nanny, or my mother would take me to the zoo. And, you know, I really grooved on the animals. You know, there was the hippopotamus, there was the crocodile, there was the aviaries, there were the sea lions. And then one day I saw this creature in a cage, which just blew me away. It was a leopard, and it was one of the most beautiful creatures I think I'd ever seen at that point, maybe ever. And as I looked into the leopard's eyes, something happened to me. And today, in trying to reach back and recapture that experience, it eludes me. But I found myself in a place of blueness.
Blueness?
It was blue.
Huh.
And the bars were gone, and there was just the leopard and myself. And the leopard looked deeply into my soul, and something happened. And from that period of time on, the leopard became kind of like my imaginary friend.
Did you go back and see him a lot?
What's that?
Did you go back and see the leopard often?
Yes, I think so. But, you know, I was young. I was really little at that point. And so, you know what memories are like when you're a young child. Mm-hmm. You know, they're kind of all mixed up together. But the fact is that, you remember that cartoon strip, Calvin and Hobbes?
Oh, yeah.
A little boy named Calvin, and he had a stuffed animal, a tiger named Hobbes.
Mm-hmm.
And Hobbes was real for him, and they would have adventures and things. They would do things together. And that's kind of what the leopard was like for me. And he would stand up on his back legs, kind of like Hobbes did. And so I came to think of him as the leopard man. And he became my sort of childhood friend. And, you know, nobody knew about him, just me and him. And he wouldn't come into my apartment building. You know, he liked to stick to the bushes in Central Park. I didn't realize it at the time, but leopards are sort of, they're ambush hunters, and they prefer covert operations. And then, of course, you know, as I grew up, you know, the magic and mystery of these early experiences withdrew. And they didn't really come together again until I was in that safari camp in the lower Omo Valley in Ethiopia, when I was in my late 20s, early 30s, and that's where I began to have the visions. That's where my re-enchantment really began. And it had to do with my reconnection with nature. This is part of what this book, The Re-Enchantment, is all about. It's about the re-enchantment of ourselves and the re-enchantment of our relationship with nature. Because as all shamans and medicine people know, you know, nature is where the juice is. This is where the life force is. And this is where those transpersonal forces that shamans come into relationship, this is where they reside. And, you know, when these experiences began for me in Africa, you know, I wasn't prepared at all. And those days I worshipped solely at the altar of science. You know,
mm-hmm.
And
which for you, that's a dramatic way for you too. That's a big change to go from science to where you are today.
Well, I'll give you an example, and this is one of the stories in The Re-Enchantment. I remember I was out doing an excavation one day with a group of African men. There were two Wakamba tribesmen from Kenya, and there was a Dasnach tribesman from that region who was a shaman named Otiko. And we were excavating a site that was about 3 million years old, maybe a little bit older. And there were fossils that were coming out, you know, and we go there day after day with our paintbrushes and our trowels and our picks and shovels and so forth and so on. And I began to have this very strange experience, like I was being watched by something. Now, when you're in East Africa, you know, and you're some distance from where the Land Rover is parked, and you feel that something is watching you, this is a kind of uneasy-making experience because, you know, there were lions and leopards and buffaloes and hyenas out there, and those were all fairly dangerous pals. So I remember one particular day, this feeling came over me very strongly, and it was, you know, we were going to go back to camp for lunch, and the Wakamba tribesmen, Kambulu and Mathoko, were sort of loading up the equipment in the back of the Land Rover.
Hold on, Hank. We're going to hit the break. So I'm going to have you finish that story when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Hank Wesselman with us, his book, The Re-Enchantment. Hank, you were talking to us about this, I don't know, should I call it an epiphany that occurred for you? What happened?
Well, it was an epiphany, but I didn't know what epiphanies were in those days. You know, there I was out in the desert with these three African men, and, you know, I had this feeling that something was watching me, and I looked over at the man who was a shaman, and he was looking off to my left at something with some intensity, and so I slowly slid my eyes in that direction, and with my peripheral vision, I saw something, and it was big. And as I turned and looked directly toward it, it's like whatever it was stepped through a tear in the fabric of the air, leaving a momentary wrinkle that straightened out, and then it was gone.
Hmm.
And, you know, there was this swirl of something And, you know, as I've said in the book, that something seemed to have spots, but I didn't put two and two together for 10 years. It was 10 years later, when I was finishing my doctoral degree in Berkeley, that I ended up in a workshop. I'd never taken a workshop before, George, you know, and I had a lot of mixed feelings about being there because, you know, frankly, being with a bunch of flaky New Agers for the weekend didn't exactly yank my chain. But, you know, I found myself with Michael Harner, of all people, who is an anthropologist like myself, who got his degree at UC Berkeley, like I did. And I found myself paired with this very beautiful young woman with long, dark hair and dark eyes named Sandra Engerman. And she, at that time, was a graduate student in counseling psychology at the CIIS in San Francisco. I was a graduate student in Berkeley. I had no idea who she was. She had no idea who I was. But we were paired up together to do an exercise in which she journeyed or engaged in a shamanic meditation, a shamanic visioning experience. And she traveled into this world of things hidden to find a helping spirit for me. And suddenly, you know, I'm lying there on my back in this dark room, and Michael Harner is beating his drum and to help us alter consciousness, and Sandra Engerman is lying next to me on the floor. And, you know, suddenly she sits up and gives me this very intense look, then leans over and plants her mouth on my chest and blows into my heart. And something happened. And she sat me up and blew into the top of my head, and when the drumming came to a close, you know, she described the visionary journey that she'd taken into the dreaming of nature, which we call the lower worlds, the worlds below this one. And she described encountering a being who said it was one of my old friends who wanted to come back into my life once again, and then she proceeded to describe the one I used to call the Leopard Man when I was a little boy. And this blew me away, because nobody knew about the Leopard Man.
Yeah, nobody.
I thought to myself, how did she know that? Well, this was the beginning of the second half of my life. And, you know, what happened next is described in my Spirit Walker trilogy, when I began to have these spontaneous visionary experiences in which my conscious awareness was drawn into connection with the soul, the mind, and the body of a man who lives in the future. Those are the books recorded in Spirit Walker, Medicine Maker, and Vision Seeker. And we've talked about those in the past. You know, this was an extraordinary adventure that went on for about 20 years and then suddenly stopped. And when I would be connected with this man, it was like I was there. And I mean, I was really there. You know, I thought they were dreams at first, until I began to learn more about who the shaman is and what shamans can do. And, you know, I came to the conclusion that I was visioning like traditional indigenous shamanic practitioners, shamans, you know, in tribal societies. And these went on for a long time. They deepened and stabilized, and they formed the core of those three books that I've just mentioned, which have gotten very widely read, by the way, 13, 14 languages abroad.
That's huge, Hank. Good for you.
And, you know, I've never read anything quite like them, because it involves time traveling. If I've got this right, and I believe I do, this man whose name is Nainoa lives approximately 5,000 years after the collapse of Western civilization in a slice of reality, a future world, which is completely unlike anything that we have today. It's more like a neo-paleolithic or a neolithic world, in the sense that our high technology is completely gone. And at the beginning of these visions, this man was leaving his community to go on a walk, a long walk of geographic investigation into the interior of the lost continent of America. Now, you know, most scientists in my field would go to great lengths never to be associated with books like this. They would never write them. They would never admit to having experiences like that. But, you know, here I was drawn into this experience. And being a field worker, you know, whenever I'm in the field, I always take copious notes and keep journals.
Well, that's the scientist in you.
And so those three books are part of that. That foray into the future, I guess you could call it. And then, you know, my other books have followed. You know, this most recent one, The Reenchantment, is really a celebration of the fact that I've turned 75 years old, believe it or not. I can't believe I've lasted this long, considering some of the experience.
You're going to keep going.
Huh?
You'll keep going.
But, you know, what I've done is I've created a kind of journal of a lot of the bump-in-the-night experiences that I've had on the trail, on the magical mystery road of life. And, you know, there are encounters with the winds, for example, the spirit of the winds. And, you know, I wrote that chapter on the masters of deception. You know, sounds true. My publisher was very interested in having me make a pass across the dark side of the force, because there are not that many people who write about shamanism or who write about mystic experience who go in that direction. So I said, you sure you want me to write about that? And they said, oh, yeah, we want you to write about that. So I did. And, you know, I thought you'd find that chapter particularly interesting, George. Did you manage to get through it?
Not on that one. I didn't, but we will get to that one indeed. I was fascinated with the story about Hawaii and the situation with the little girl there.
The little girl in Hawaii?
The little friend. Sophie?
The Sophia.
Is that what you call her, Sophie? Sophia? Something about her dream?
Yes, the Sophia. The Sophia is the soul of our world. The Sophia is the soul of our world. And according to the Gnostics, the philosophers of the ancient world, who, by the way, were exterminated by the Christians, the Sophia was one of the ions, spelled A-E-O-N-S. Ions are great creator beings that live in the core of our galaxies. I guess you could call them aliens, because they're certainly not human.
Are they physical?
No, they're not physical. They're sort of mental-minded, spiritual beings. And they're essentially, I believe, they're involved in the creation of galaxies and life within the galaxies. And one of these ions was called the Sophia, spelled Sophia. And she's the one who dreamed the dream of what the Greeks called the Anthropos, the dream of humanity. And she fell in love with her dream. And so she left the safety of the core, the galactic core, which the Gnostics called the Pleroma, and she flowed out into the arms of chaos, the Kenoma, those great spiral arms that galaxies form when they revolve. And she didn't come out as a winged superhuman like an angel. She came out as a river of conscious light. And she came into a relationship with a star, with our star, with the sun, and she solidified, and this planet is her physical body, and her soul, which is called the Sophia, or the Greeks called Gaia, resides in the biosphere, in the living sphere around this planet itself.
Is she supposed to represent everything that's good about the planet, Hank?
Well, she represents everything that's in the planet. You know, and that includes both the good and the not good, both the light and the dark.
And you mentioned the dark in this book, which I found different, because normally you don't go that way. We'll get into that chapter, The Masters of Deception, in a moment.
Okay.
But she's not just the good, she's everything.
Well, you could say that all the gods and goddesses are manifestations of her. She is the overriding planetary goddess, and she's definitely a she, because she gives birth. You know, I mean, you look at I look at the land. I live here on the Big Island in this wonderful acre of land down south of Captain Cook, and the life force is unbelievable. You know, the vines and the trees and the flowers and the plants, you know, you can just see the life force proliferating here, because her presence is very strong here. I think it has to do with the active volcano in the middle of this island.
Oh, it hasn't stopped, has it?
Yeah, and the fact that the island is surrounded by water. There's something very special about volcanoes and lakes, volcanoes and rivers, volcanoes and oceans. That seems to be where the life force is most densely concentrated. years ago, I was invited to go to Brazil to teach at an institute. And while I was there for 2 weeks, we engaged in 5 ayahuasca ceremonies. And I'd never taken any hallucinogens before. This was a new experience for me. And in one of those experiences, my intention was that I wanted to actually see the life force. And I was given that experience. I was given that experience. This was really quite extraordinary.
Were you scared?
I would say it was more like I was awestruck. I was completely blown away because I wasn't prepared for what I perceived. For starters, the life force is blue. That was a big, amazement to me. It's not water. I guess you could say it's energy, but it's blue energy.
Which is the same thing you saw when you were a little boy.
Maybe it was. I never even put that together until just now. Thank you, George.
There you go. There you go. But, did you imbibe the ayahuasca?
I did. I did 5 ayahuasca ceremonies. And I'll have to say that although I found ayahuasca a very interesting experience, I had one experience where I had to fight for my life for 5
God.
Hours with something really dark, and I didn't enjoy that.
Oh, my
God. I didn't enjoy that. And the next day when we were all downloading our experiences in the group and everybody was talking about it, I described this in some detail, and everybody looked at me and said, Hank, this is about surrender. You got to surrender to this. And I said,
Don't say it.
I won't say it. I said, look, I've been involved in the shaman's path for more than 30 years, and the shaman has to be the master of spirits. That's the way it has to be. The shaman has to be the boss. You don't turn over your power to transpersonal forces because you can get yourself in a lot of trouble. And a lot of people who get into shamanic work don't understand that. But, I've had some extraordinary experiences. And, as I say in this book, The Reenchantment, it all had to do with my relationship with nature. This is where the reenchantment really began. And it still goes on there today.
Has being a shaman helped you to be a better scientist?
Well, I would never claim this, George, but let's just put it this way. My project in Ethiopia, which I was engaged in the Awash Valley, was extraordinarily successful. And when I arrived in the field, everybody had very long faces because they'd been out there for a month or two and not much had been found. And once I arrived in the field, and, I'm not going to claim anything here, but we began to make discoveries, very heavy-duty discoveries. And it continued the entire time I was in the field for the next couple of years. So I would say yes. I think that, my shamanic abilities, which were refined across time, and we can talk a little bit about who the shaman is and who the shaman isn't, I would say that they sensitized me. I began to pay attention to the shadows. I began to pay attention to the winds and the light and the birds and the bees, and my life changed dramatically in response to this. This is when I began to be drawn into connection with these transpersonal forces, which the traditional people call spirits.
And yet, in the book, The Reenchantment, you did devote a chapter to what you call the masters of deception.
I did, yeah.
And I call it pure evil. Tell me why you included that.
Well, I've been very curious about what's going on in our world. And I came across a word on the internet, the word egregore. And I had never heard that word before. And so being in touch with my spirit teacher, all of us have a spirit teacher, and part of my goal as a shamanic teacher is to bring people into connection with their helping spirits and their teaching spirits. And once their spirits are in relationship with them, my job is to get out of the way. But I turned towards my spirit teacher, and I asked about this word egregore. And I was told that an egregore is a non-material psychic entity or minded energetic field uniting members of a group. or organization, like a religion or state or corporation or political party, an association or cult, for example. And these egregores, these psychic entities, are generated and maintained by the thought energy, in other words, the belief systems of the group members. These entities, in turn, can influence the individuals as well as the collective psyche of the group members, taking on a life of their own, which may persist even when the original members of the group leave or pass on. Now, the words psychic entity and egregore reveal that an egregore is not a spirit. It's not a spirit at all. Rather, egregores are dense collective thought forms that have been created by humans, and once their continued existence in the mental focus of their believers is maintained by the belief systems and the attention of their believers, they can then live on in the dreaming of the spirit world, taking on, you know, a kind of parasitic relationship with human beings. They're kind of like mind parasites. And as I said, they're not spirits. They're thought forms, and they reside in the human mind as uninvited guests. And the curious thing about them is that the indigenous people have been aware of them for a long time. I discussed the existence of these beings with the Kahuna Halemakua, who was the subject of my book, The Bowl of Light. And I also found a Jungian analyst who lives in Portland, who wrote a book called Dispelling, I think it's called Dispelling Wetiko. A Wetiko is a it's a Cree Indian word for one of these psychic entities, which is dangerous, which is malevolent. And the way in which these psychic entities operate...
They sound like demons too, Hank, don't they?
Well, the Kahuna called them interdimensional demons. He called them an alien mindset. And he said that they infect people who are vulnerable to their influence, and they encourage them to go ever deeper into the negative polarity until they reach a point where they can no longer self-correct. And when they can no longer self-correct, there's a kind of threshold. And if you step across that threshold, you step into the realm of evil. And, you know, the whole problem of evil in our world today is a very powerful one, because these egregores, these psychic entities, these wetikos, tend to attach themselves to our religious leadership, our political leadership, our cultural leadership, our economic leadership. And in all fairness, these individuals, and we won't name names, you know, these individuals are quite unaware
that they've been attached. We're going to take a break, Hank. We're going to come right back, and I do want to talk more about that, how these evil things, these entities, attach themselves. And then we'll take some time with some phone calls. Hank Wesselman with us. His book is called The Re-Enchantment.